I mean, you know, bearing in mind, I think the first time I ever encountered Shavasana meditation, the instruction was that, you know, I place my attention on the breath and shut out all thoughts. Well, you know, fine chance. Well, I don't know where they came up with that one. I thought this must be for very advanced people, just turn them off. Really? So I thought, no, without being further critical about those instructions, I was kind of like, it's not for me, that one. It's not too bad to always have the breath in the background, because I think if you're doing what is being suggested here and you're just present to whatever's going on, there's nothing wrong with the breath being part of it. So if you're aware of whatever the rhythm of the breath is, if that's a part of your experience, and that's familiar and you've trained in it, I think that's okay. What would be like, but don't grab hold of it and then push everything else away. Just open up. And of course the breath is part of the experience. In shamatha without an object, anything that arises in experience is okay. And if there's a kind of a central core breath sensation in that, great. Don't have to throw it away. But, you know, dropping it as the primary object of attention doesn't mean excluding it. That might help too. Yeah, it was kind of like that. It's kind of, you know, sit down, shut up and get out. Oh, yeah, it'd be really good if I could, but it's possible. Well, I naively tried, of course, didn't I? And I thought, I'm really no good at this. Another kind person suggested, well, actually, maybe you can't stop thought. Oh, yes. It goes on all the while we're alive. And, you know, there are some times when there's more of it than others, and sometimes where there's none for a bit. You do get gaps. Mm. Great. Enjoy, you know. But when it comes back, don't be disappointed. Mm. And if you, exactly as you were saying, if you just see it as part of the weather, you know, it's like, it's fine. It's there or it's not there. Mm. It's like we can... Because I always quite liked silence, sometimes I used to get annoyed with background noise. Mm. See, I'm sort of one of those people that when I get up in the morning, I never put the radio on. I don't watch the television. And if anybody else does, I'm thinking like, oh, noise. I'm not quite like that now, but that's how I was. So I thought, well, I've got to deal with it, because other people, I'm living in a space with other people than you. You can't deal with that. I thought, well, there's always some sort of background noise. There's never complete silence. Why not just why see that as an irritation? You know, unless it's at full volume or being brought into your room or whatever it is. Just see it as background noise. Mm. And sure enough, there's a kind of awareness of it and it's almost gone. Mm. And even if it is there, it's no more than the hum I can hear now. I'm not quite sure how much of that's in here, how much is the world, but it doesn't disturb me, it's just there. So kind of like that. About a quarter past. Well, we're having a talk on Q&A. I mean, I can move into, you know, appreciation of interdependence and dependence arising. But if there are any more questions like this, I'm quite happy to keep it going in an open way. Yes, nice. They are. Both are true. There's a bit of Buddhist two truths in there, ultimate truth and conventional truth. Yeah, that they're, if you look at it from an ultimate point of view, there really isn't any difference. There's... We're thoughts without a thinker. Yeah. However, it appears to exist in a way that it doesn't. So it appears like that, but it doesn't really exist like that. So as Dujon Rinpoche was saying, minds don't own or possess thoughts as separate entities. But however, if you are very identified with sort of clinging on to over reified thoughts, then a good beginning is to say, hang on, thoughts are not facts. Thoughts are not facts. They're not. I am not my thoughts. It's entirely legitimate to say that. Yeah. In the same way, if we go back to the shamatha example, in the beginning of the shamatha with an object model, it's full of phrases like, watch your mind. Watch your mind, yeah? And or watch the breath. Put the attention on the breath. Mm-hmm. Because it's setting up something conventionally that kind of responds to the way things appear, even though they don't ultimately exist like that, mm-hmm. to kind of get something going. Space. But this is a kind of a pragmatic, mm-hmm. contrived device mm-hmm. to make something happen. Yeah. So if you create that space mm-hmm. and do that, but if that goes on for a very long time, if that itself becomes held on to, then the samadhi is not possible, because there's always me mm-hmm. and the thing I'm watching. Mm-hmm. And the ultimate stage of shamatha is a union of those two. Mm-hmm. So if you over-reify the bifurcation that was set up for good pragmatic purposes, then at some point you have to get rid of that one. An easy way, I think, experientially to actually experience it, is if you go back to shamatha on the breath. So I'm now sort of watching the breath. I've got some notion, some contrived notion, that I'm going to peg my attention to the sensations of the breath in the body as they come in and go out. Yeah? And that gives me an idea of what to do. And quite a clear idea of, if the attention wanders, you know, the mindfulness is in the attention, remember, and the introspection, which is the other mental factor, involves, like the quality controller says, oh, you got lost in trying to answer the question and the breath's gone, so come back to the breath, kind of thing. And that's all going on. So that's that slight bifurcation with one part of the mind watching another, yeah, kind of reified and personified as two, like two different things, yeah. But then I could get to a point where I might say, well, what if there's nobody watching the breath? Or use the breath because it's an easier and more tangible example. What if there's nobody watching the breath, but I just am present in the breath? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, it, like a near place to that would be, instead of watching, I'll bring the attention in and surf on the breath. Yeah. And then the surfboard will disappear, presence will sink into, the attention is actually in the awareness of the sensations. And then already there's hardly any watcher or watched. Mm-hmm. There is no difference between the experiencer and the experienced. And there's nothing profoundly mystical about that. It's just the way it is. Yeah. So then there is just presence. And you then from there, from that experience, you can begin to see what this sort of language is talking about, and saying there actually really isn't an observer and an observed. There's the, like, sometimes at the Buddhist Society, I'll say, when you've dropped the object and you're in shamatha without an object, then just take a glance, you know, kind of invert the attention or the awareness on itself and focus on the experiencer rather than the experience. Mm-hmm. Focus on the meditator rather than what's meditated upon. Yeah? And just rest right there. Because there's no difference between the two. We've set up a contrived thing to arrive there. And actually, this question has come right back to here. We all the time feel that there is some separate thing running, observing, watching our lives, and that it exists in a way that it doesn't. In actual fact, there's only our presence to, or awareness of, what's happening.
There's often that image of the mirror, the mind as the mirror.
Yes. Yeah, that's another it's a very fabulous analogy. I mean, there's another one which I think is also helpful in this, which is if anybody ever reads or listens to any of Alex Berzin's stuff as a translator, and he did, I still think it's an outstanding piece of work in working with His Holiness and translating His Holiness's teaching on the Gelugpagi Mahamudra system. Well, in there, in the beginning, he's saying, "What it's the translation problem again?" In the same way, why do in Buddhist books do they leave dukkha rather than translate it? Even though you get these very elaborate kind of explanations of suffering, but they come back to dukkha because it's not quite right. But if you get enough pointing at what it is, you can come back to using the word that was used in the first place. And if you have a look, it's not very far in where he's talking about the translation terms. And he said, mind, for us, it's not only us, there are other cultures too, but mind for us is a problem. Yeah? Because he said, actually, the best translation word would be experience. Mm. Not experience in the sense of have you got any experience, or I have experience. But it's like pointing to what is happening right now. I'm alive, vibrant, wonderful, alive, feeling. I'm aware of everything that's coming in through the five senses, mental consciousness. There's a vivacity. That whole shooting match is the word citta, which we translate as mind. And we, unfortunately, are in a culture that think that's something in your head. Or some people even say, oh, it's the brain, isn't it? So what about this bit? So the Chinese and the Mongolians, they've got a translation that's something like heart-mind, which is actually coming back into popularity in English. Because it's saying, we're not some... Because of the dominance of sight... There's a sense, and the way that evolutionary thing, it creates the impression that the mind is something that is in our brain behind our eyes. Yeah? Well, you can feel your foot now. I've mentioned it, can't you? It's a sensation of your foot. You know where it is, where it's on the floor. You can feel the socks. Was that any less or more my mind, or somewhere outside of it? It's the five senses and mental consciousness. That's a way of carving up the totality of our experience. So when we're reading citta as mind, that's what it's pointing at. The whole shooting match. Yeah. That's why I think it makes it much more difficult for us when we're talking about the emptiness of the mind and not reifying it, because we think, there's somebody in there. I don't know whether it still persists, but because I'm an old git, my children's comics were filled with... Everybody would have a strip somewhere that would show you all these little creatures.
The numbskulls,
that's it. Those are they. Or you have, if you did sort of medieval stuff, people used to talk about the homunculus.
Yes.
Or, in Cartesian times, the ghost in the machine. Yeah. Well, when... From a Buddhist perspective, you're talking about the emptiness of that. What it means is that one doesn't exist. It kind of appears that way.
Well, the numbskulls don't
exist. Yeah, the numbskulls don't exist. The homunculus doesn't exist. There's no ghost in the machine. So what have I got? Well, you've got pretty healthily what you've got. Do you need more? Here I am doing what I'm doing. Is there some separate Roy that I could extract and put over there? No. You were reading the Alex Berzin, weren't you?
Yes.
Do you know where it is?
Yeah, I'll put it back now.
If you know where it is and pop it in, I'll just read the bit, if you don't mind. That'd
it's
be
an
great.
Amazing book.
Yeah. Yeah, so the it was like it's again this idea that we kind of we drive the body and decide to do, like the driver of a car. And it's, when you see the numbskulls, it's very funny. It's a cartoon, and except with them, even better. There was a crowd of them, and they argued, and there was a fat controller and all sorts of things, you know. That's what made the fun of the cartoon. And there is, from a conventional point of view, you can make all sorts of interesting and useful observations because, of course, we're not a unity. You know, we think we're a unity, but we're not. So the arguments between the numbskulls, you know, is entirely understandable, and then one would talk to the other, and it's all great. But the problem is, I'm going to be boring again. We reify it, solidify it, and say it is like that. So instead of being an informative analogy or metaphor, we think that's how it is. So you know, what I was fed as cartoons as a kid ended up being a completely erroneous idea about who Roy was or who Roy is. It kind of informed it without even thinking about it, along with all the other conditioning and stuff like that. Here it is. I found it. So here's the benefit of what I was talking about in respect of Alex. He says, let's now turn to the actual practice of Mahamudra, meditation on the nature of mind. When we raise the topic of the nature of mind, we of course need to explore first what we mean by mind. This is because if we're asked to focus and meditate on the nature of mind, or on mind itself, we may find it not very obvious what we are intended to do. To investigate this, we must look closely at the definition of mind in Buddhism. As soon as we look at the standard definition, we discover that Buddhism is talking about something quite different from what we mean by any of our corresponding Western words. Even in Western languages, there's no consensus on the meaning of mind. If we speak just in terms of English and German, there's a great difference between the English word mind and the German word Geist. Geist also has a connotation of spirit that is not included in the English concept of mind. The classical Asian Buddhist languages of Sanskrit and Tibetan speak of something quite different from both, and the difference between what they refer to as mind and what the corresponding Western terms refer to is much greater than between the reference of the equivalent English and German terms. The problem of how to translate the Buddhist concept into a Western word is obviously very challenging. In Western languages, we differentiate clearly between mind and heart, or intellect and feelings. We think of the intellectual rational side as mind and the emotional intuitive side as heart, something quite different from mind. Many Westerners would say that although a dog has emotions, it has no mind. In Buddhism, however, we do not make such a large gap between intellect and emotions. We incorporate the functions of both under the rubric of one word, citta in Sanskrit or sem in Tibetan. And that's also noticed less so if people from China or India or whatever have been to Western universities or exposed to a lot of Western stuff on media. But once upon a time, if you said, where's your mind? They'd do this. We'd do this. You just ask the simple question. I've been there and done it. That's how they do it. We incorporate the functions of both under the rubric of one word, and he's talking from the Buddhist perspective, citta in Sanskrit or sem in Tibetan, and includes as well the scope of its meaning, in the scope of its meaning, all sense perception. such as seeing, hearing, smelling, and so on. Thus, although we translate Chitta or Sem with the English word mind or the German word Geist, the Sanskrit and Tibetan Buddhist terms encompass a much larger scope of meaning than either the German or English renderings of the term. The problem's not limited to Western languages. Mongolian also differentiates between the intellectual and emotional sides, but unlike English, uses the term for the latter, Setgil, in Buddhist texts. The Chinese translators as well chose the word meaning heart, Jin, which the Japanese also accepted and used. The issue of what is mind brings to the surface many fundamental differences in cultural worldviews. If we want to find a better synonym for the Indo-Tibetan terms in European languages, perhaps the closest equivalent is the word experience. Although this word too is not quite precise, we do not include in its meaning here experience in the sense of familiarity and expertise through repetition, as in the doctor has a great deal of experience. Furthermore, in Western languages, to experience something often implies to feel emotions about it, either positive or negative. We feel we have not really experienced something deeply unless we've consciously been moved by it on an emotional level. This is also not included in the Buddhist notion, nor is there any connotation of evaluation, as in, I learned a lot from that experience. In the Buddhist context, experience is merely whatever happens to us, whatever occurs. That's Chitta, that's mind.
Could I page reference
to that?
What's the page?
It's page 60 in An Introduction to Mahamudra in the Gelug Kagyu tradition of Mahamudra by His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Alex Bersin. Right. But again, I'm pleased that that came up, as it came from the discussion originally in meditation, because that's really important when we get to saying, but what is mind? What are you resting in? This is why in Mipham's instructions he's saying, okay, if you haven't got any idea, you have this idea of drawing your attention into the empty space at your heart. But then a little further on he says, but it's the same as just letting it be. Well, letting what be? The whole shooting match. Right? You know, and you could say, but it would be a conventional thing and not quite true, okay, just kind of centre yourself in the middle of all of that. But not here, pervading the whole lot of it.
Yeah.
And just rest there.
So is presence not a better word?
Presence, I love presence. That's why I've been using presence. Sorry. Be present. Even sometimes it's like, oh, say, or be present to it.
Mm.
Just presence, or presence in it.
Mm-hmm.
All the time trying to get rid of that bifurcation.
What about awareness? Is that...
Well, the point is the awareness thing. The awareness is good. Like sometimes I to and it's kind of an Alan Wallace thing as well. I think I remember rightly. To get away from this experiencer and experienced kind of thing, it's like if I pay attention to what I can see. If I say, bring your attention to the gates of the five senses, yeah? So I'm going to pay attention to what can be seen, what can be heard, what can be smelt, what can be tasted, and the body. So what am I bringing my attention to? I'm bringing my attention to the awareness that pervades that experience. So, yeah, what you're talking about is getting close. But very often, if you're not careful, people who want to hold on and reify it say, well, what's awareness then?
Exactly.
It's empty, it's clear, and it's cognizant, and it pervades every aspect of your experience. But these are all, you see what I mean? They're all conventional terms, but if we play enough in the right way, we kind of get an idea of what's going on and get away from over-reifying or thinking, oh, well, it has to be like that. And then we concretize that and miss the point. Because it's not about something behind my eyes. It's not about something in the middle of my brain. It includes the feelings of my foot, my body, my emotions, sight, smell, taste, hearing. And when I'm settling in that, that's why I like Alex's. I mean, as he says, it's not perfect because of the other connotations we've got, but I think I can easily drop those and just say, I'm resting in the awareness of the totality of my experience, if that's not too many words. Still, in body, speech and mind, with the senses vividly alive, you know, like that. That's it. That's enough. Just, does that make sense?
Yeah.
But it's good that it came up, because otherwise the terminology is a problem. And then to complicate it, different translators very often have slightly different ideas about which word to use or which emphasis to put.
I was suggesting the term subjectivity.
Subjectivity?
Subjectivity.
Yeah, I like that because as long as we just stick with the subjectivity and don't see it as the polar opposite of an objectivity. Because that's another one. We use the language, and as long as we leave it at a kind of conventional level and don't hang on to it too much, I can say, my thoughts are not out there, they're in here. Yeah? Here I go again. See? Failed conditioning. But, you know, somehow they're internal rather than external. And we all understand. It's like, yeah, I'm not talking about something out there. I'm talking about something that's in my mind. But in actual fact, there is no in here and out there. It's just a convenient way of dividing up, conceptual way of dividing it up so you know what we're talking about. But if we think it actually exists that way, it's not really like that, is it? Because my thoughts in that sense, although it sounds surprising because we're so addicted to the model, and my thoughts don't have any location. This can have a location because it's about direction, space, it's relative to all of that and it makes sense. But a thought doesn't look like that, does it? In fact, there's even a lot of confusion about, well, so what am I referring to when I say a thought? So sometimes I have to say propositional thoughts, images, big background emotions, memories, commentary, undercurrent thought, processing. These are all, again, from the Buddhist point of view, if you look at the Sanskrit and Tibetan words, it includes all of that. The English word thought, which tends to be dominated by psychologists and philosophers, they mean a propositional thought. Yeah, it's not a sentence, and that it's a specific unit that's got a beginning, a middle, an end, and a syntax and a grammar, and is expressible in language. If it's not, then it's a feeling or a feeling tone or some other, a thousand other things. So it's a very specific thing, a thought. But out of the Sanskrit and Tibetan, when they say thought, they mean any mental event. Any mental event at all. In a way, it's sort of complex and rich. And at first you think, oh my God, what am I going to do with this? But actually, it's not that hard. You just think, hang on, just don't hang on to the terms too tightly. Mm. Don't get too... You know, there can be a need for precision sometimes, but if you don't need it, keep it wide and worth paying attention to... You don't have to become a scholar, but just a few of the key terms. Mm. And think, oh yeah, so mind isn't... This quite the same as the Western. It's this, we'd be much better thinking the totality of our experience.
I was just saying this morning when you were talking about when you were doing the guided meditation and saying from the heart to the mind, my thoughts were going to the heart space. I was thinking it would be coming in my heart and then it would go back to my head.
Yeah, yeah.
But just thinking of the presence or the experience, I think, will stop that.
Yeah, it's a good one because I think he does it himself here, the way he's thinking, oh, well, I've got to sort of I'm giving people instructions on how to do this. And so he says, draw your ordinary awareness, that which is vividly clear, open and brilliant, that's into the empty centre of your heart, knowing that people will kind of visualise an empty centre here and kind of centre their awareness there, yeah, and allow it to settle. This is what is meant by mind being turned upon itself, knowing that some people might say, well, how do I do that? He's saying, well, try, it is a method of doing it. Sort of put it in here. And then he says, if mind exists, it should be found within the body, but it isn't to be found, not in the heart, nor anywhere else for that matter. So he's letting you know that this was a kind of conventional way of doing something, to set something up. Then he goes through all of that, kind of the rest of the instructions. And then when you come towards the end of the instructions, he says, placing mind within your heart, or simply letting your mind be. These are essentially the same. So some, if I said, just kind of rest and let your mind be, do nothing, don't poke about with it, some people might say, oh, got it. Other people might say, well, where is the mind? What is it I'm not supposed to be poking about? Oh, well, that's going to take us in a very counterproductive direction. Bring the attention into the heart, you know, feel it there, and then just settle. But then he's giving you hints later on that this is just a device to just get you to the point where you're... I mean, maybe you could be really... be a bit too simplistic, but I think what's being got at the beginning is to say, is it possible to find a really comfortable posture, allow the body to relax? I love his suggestion, as if you were going to sleep. Because, of course, what we try to do when we want to go to sleep, I'm someone who always sleeps relatively easily, but some people, if you have any difficulty getting to sleep, then you know what you want to do is you want to shut everything down. So you don't want a bright screen, right? You don't want to read. You just want, and if a thought comes up, you don't want to hang on to it. You don't want to take that ride because it'll keep you awake. So you're just disengaging. And the body, you're just finding a comfortable position and leave it. And then you know if you do that for long enough, successfully, you'll fall asleep. So he's inviting you to meditate in that way. The difference being is, just as you've settled there, then just keep a balance between alertness and dullness. Don't let it slip into dullness. And just enough effort to remain present. Job done. The rest will happen, and you'll be present to everything that happens. And if you're present to everything that happens, as he suggests there, insight will dawn naturally out of shamatha, because you'll see it. Really, if you're, if you were present, yeah. Much of the gaps and holes in the continuity of consciousness would become apparent. You'd experience them to a greater degree. There'd be a great, much better chance of experiencing them. Let's suppose that I'm thinking all the time, yeah? So that I think really the thoughts are always going on. There's always there's always the noise there. So even though it's actually lots of individual ones, it creates the illusion of the continuity of consciousness. But if I sit in meditation, or sometimes it can happen that if I'm, say, sitting on a bench up there looking at the landscape or the sunlight or whatever, it can be a thousand million reasons why, there is suddenly a moment of utter stillness. Nothing going on. I'm present to it. And then all of a sudden, maybe a bird will fly. Oh, was that? And then another thought will come up, and then that will relate to something else, and then I could be quite easily washing thoughts about being on buses in London and all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And then they may subside down again. And where do they go? Sometimes they just... something that can really pull me in meditation, and I'm thinking, no, I want to go there. And then it's just managing by your device to keep a bit of separation. And then it changes or transforms into something else. And then when I've finished, I might think, where did that go? It seemed so powerful and alluring at the time. Or it might just sink back into the space of consciousness. And there's just pure presence in the moment, but you're present to the gap between the moments or events that create the illusion of continuity. Is that what you said? Gaps between the thoughts, if you like. Yeah. Between each mental event, which is, in Buddhist terms, what you're talking about, the thoughts. Yeah, maybe another, again, it's good never to hang on too hard to any analogy, because it's pointing in the direction of something, give you an idea of it. But imagine that by, this is an attempt, I'm brainstorming, as it were. When you sit as being described now in meditation, and everything is shutting down, kind of, it's also with external stimuli, either with the attention being turned away from the external stimuli in on itself, so not looking for stuff outside, in an environment, when we're trying to meditate formally, we don't want a lot of noise, we want shanti, we don't want big variations in the light and all of that, so it's all kind of shutting down. The presence will be present to something that's the nearest I could kind of grab for a metaphor. Imagine if pre-digital you were watching a film and then the projectionist slowed it down, you'd begin to see
individual frame.
Yeah. Does that make sense?
You'd
be able to see them or experience them. Like, that's the other one. We're dominated by sight, aren't we? So this one, you say, you can watch your mind. Well, you don't use your eyes to watch your mind, do you? Come on. We know what it means because we're using it by analogy. Because it's just because for human beings, sight is such a dominant sense. I often think if I'm writing or talking, can I get that one out? Think of putting it another way so I don't have to say see it. Because otherwise people tend... It all reduces to the way we see things. Yeah. Insight sometimes better. Yeah. The mirror is a good analogy, but it's, don't forget, it's an analogy. So first of all, the mirror and the reflections in it is used in lots of different ways, but very often in meditation. Let's take the one where it's the, if you imagine a mirror covered up completely in the darkness, it's not reflecting anything, but it's still there, shiny, or with nothing in it. But when you uncover it, as soon as something appears in the mirror, the reflection of something appears in the mirror, that's the relationship between the experience, if you like, or the contents of experience and what we're calling the mind. It's very similar to the sky one and the clouds, right? But it is only an analogy. And then also you have to think, there's the mirror analogy, but the mind's not two-dimensional. So you'd have to think of a mirror being a 360-degree sphere. And very often in the Tibetan tradition, one of the visualized images of it is as a clear spherical crystal. But then it doesn't actually have any limits. So extend it limitlessly. Oh, you see what I mean? Then the analogies are useful, but you have to keep questioning them and stretching them to get what they're pointing at. Otherwise, the mirror and its contents start to become two separate things. It's seen as two-dimensional, and then we're watching what's in the mirror, and we're way away from what was trying to be conveyed. They might be useful in different ways at different times, so they're worth keeping about. That's why a lot of the meditation instructions in all of the traditions sort of got four, five, six, seven, sometimes a few more kind of metaphors, you know, of how it is. It's like for when we're very tight around a thought or around an experience, when we're really, you know, when we're over concretizing it and reifying it, and it appears very solid, appearing in a way that it appearing to exist in a way that it doesn't, and it's over concrete and over solid, then they'll use the water and ice analogy. Like, it might look like ice to you, but if the temperature changes, it'll melt back into water. Or it might look like a waveform to you, so distinct that it's separate to the ocean out of which it's arisen, but it's going to crash back into the sea, and it's all water. Does that mean there wasn't a wave? No. It had a relative existence for a particular period of time. Was it in any way really separate from the water? Well, it appeared to be. Was it anything other than water? No. So there's... it's all mind. We talk about it in these ways and identify various bits of it and use the analogies, but what they're pointing at is this very one. Does that make sense? So it's not that they're not useful. I mean, there was in the Sutra of Huai Nang, there's a very good one. He's the sixth patriarch in the what was the Chinese, well, it still is Chinese Chan, but also that becomes Zen in Japan. And he was working in the kitchen of a monastery, and the abbot of the monastery was getting old, and in the Chan and Zen traditions, there's a kind of the lineage is passed on by a transmission of mind. And the abbot wanted everybody who thought they might succeed him to write a poem so that they might express their understanding of emptiness. And for the one that he could recognise had the best understanding, he'd then pass on the transmission of mind to that person, as it were. So Hui Ling was in a difficult situation, because although he was very bright, he never went to school, so he couldn't read and write. So when he found out what was going on, he was asking a friend who could read to read him all the poems. And then they said to him, this one, without a doubt, will win the competition. And it was a poem that's saying, there is a stand, there is a mirror bright. If you keep the mirror polished, no dust will alight. And Hui Ling said, can you write something down for me? And they said, yes. So he wrote, there is no stand, there is no mirror bright, so where can the dust alight? He got the transmission of mind. But they're all metaphors, analogies, allusions, pointing at something that's kind of ultimately ineffable. It's reality itself. There's back to this, do we really think there can ever be an ultimate description of it? But that's a metaphysical question. I'm working on the fact we haven't got one. So until someone finds one, this is the way to work. Yeah. Now, the gong will go in a minute, won't it? Yeah, should do. Anyway, that's a good... There it is. We're good.